Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vagar Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. Joining us now to discuss the week on world markets are Dr. Rocket Ron Epstein of Bank of America Merrill Lynch, joining us this week by phone, Sash Tusa of the independent equity research firm Agency Partners in London, and Richard Abalafia of the Thiel Group Consultancy, normally in Washington, D.C., but now in sunny Bahaba, Maine. Guys, thanks very much for joining us.
Great to be here, Vagar. Thanks.
It's good to be here, Vagar.
Greetings from Maine, Vagar.
And before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri, Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. And of course, Bell sponsors this podcast. Guys, we're still seeing some crazy behavior from the market. Profits in Asia are down 73% for the quarter, which was sort of bracing. China says, and is as far as we could tell, showing that its markets are surging, and officials there are touting the vaunted slow bull in motion. Elsewhere, everybody is worried about a double dip recession and cases coming back. We've seen, when we discussed this last week, some cases back in Europe. Australia is seeing a surge of cases, aside from Brazil and Russia, of course. India, of course, still facing enormous challenges. United States is still getting worse as the fatality rate continues. Congress looks like it may be getting its fourth stimulus act together next week. Europe fortunately put its package together. And then we've got sort of the broader decay of the relationship, not just between Washington and Beijing, but also London and Beijing, Paris and Beijing, and soon to be Berlin and Beijing as well, over 5G and espionage, Chinese consulate being closed in Houston, China responding in Chengdu. Ron, start us off, right? I mean, obviously you're not Bank of America Merrill Lynch's chief economist, but you know, what are sort of the broad trends you find interesting? And then Sash, to get your take on it, and then Richard, yours.
Yeah, I would say, you know, a couple things. This week we saw the defense stocks in the U.S. start to catch a bid after probably 6-7 weeks of weakness. And I think that was a bit on the heels of some of the earnings reports and what companies said this week. But also, I think what's going on between the U.S. and China was a reminder of, you know, protection power in the Pacific, so on and so forth. So all of that, I think, kind of came together to give the defense stocks a bit of a bid. Commercial aerospace, on the other hand, seems to be languishing a bit, largely because what we've seen most of the airlines talk about in the U.S. is about capacity not coming back at rates that they thought. You know, every major U.S. airline has said that. If you look at the TSA numbers, we're still down 78, 79, call it 80% year over year. So it, you know, we're, that Nike swoosh in terms of recovery of air traffic really seems to be playing out. As we said many times, you know, the virus has a say, and the virus flaring back up in different parts of the country, and in fact, different parts of the world, doesn't make it any easier for, you know, the air transportation system to get back to some, you know, form of stability and normalcy. And I think that was, you know, backed up in some of the other results we heard on commercial aerospace. So, you know, my sense is it seems like there's a little bit of a malaise. You know, when you step out of my world and you start to see headlines now about folks worrying about the valuations on tech companies and this and that. But also, we're in the midsummer months. Once we get through earnings, we would expect people to kind of go on vacations and you know, trading volumes to get really thin. So we'll see what happens here. But you know, this upcoming week's a big week for us in terms of earnings. So I think we'll get a clearer view on maybe the directionality of the aerospace and defense sector once we get through this week.
And a little bit later in the program, we're going to be taking a look at folks who have already reported, including Lockheed. Sash, take it away in terms of you know, what you're seeing, what investors are telling you, and the data points you're watching.
Yeah, I think the interesting thing about the stocks over here in Europe, and I'm going to focus on the A&D stocks because, you know, that's what we're all interested in, is overall they just slipped this week. I think that there has been, the results weren't stellar by any stretch of the imagination, although they were clearly very, very well trailed. But I think that there is just concern that the pandemic is getting worse, not better. I mean, people were pretty optimistic 10 days ago, lots of talk about a vaccine and so forth. And then actually, you know, the really interesting thing, the big second spike or second surge over here in Europe has been Spain. Spain has gone from having a few tens of, a few hundreds of cases a day up to into the, you know, low thousands again. The UK overnight put a 14-day quarantine order on all arrivals from Spain. That took people really by surprise. The airlines have been absolutely screaming about the effect, and the tour companies about the effect it's having on them. But it really shows, you know, as you said, the virus has a say too. Actually, in general, you know, one of the most important laws of war is that incoming fire has right of way, and that's what we're seeing at the moment. There's just a lot of uncertainty about how this is going to play out. We've been seeing that in the stocks.
Sash, you incoming fire has the right of way, so you may already have won the phrase of the program. So setting a high bar as usual for.
Thank you. I'll just log out now. That's great.
that's fine. Goodbye, everybody. Yeah, exactly. All you can do at this point is screw it up. Richard, what's your sense, especially about the trade dynamic and as it's rapidly degrading. There is a sense that the administration is moving very, very rapidly to set the relationship with the United States and China going forward, even if it's no longer in office. So there's this sense that the administration is moving harder and faster to sort of set the steering, jam the throttles, jam the rudder, so that you have that full frontal collision. What are some of the takeaways over the last week in terms of data points for you?
Yeah, I think this is exactly the thing to watch. As a matter of fact, The Atlantic moved a great Peter Bainard piece this morning about sort of Operation Scorched Earth. The way the Trump administration, rightly or wrongly, is not going to leave a whole lot of latitude for any incoming administration, possibly a second Trump term, to repair anything. This is it with China. And refer you to my colleague there, Ron's comment, trade war will become tech war. Yeah, I think they might be deciding to skip a couple steps and just go on to just permanent conflict in one way or another, effectively Cold War 2.0. And to be fair to the Trumpies, it doesn't look like there's a whole lot of latitude in the Democratic side of things to change the situation either. It looks like we're settling in for something that's going to be a very strange multi-year period in which we still have reasonably good trade relations, with China, but increasingly difficult political ones, up to and including closure of embassies and other signs of Cold War 2.0. Meanwhile, the Chinese will no doubt accelerate the development of strategic import substitute products, particularly aviation. And, U.S. companies and Western companies doing business in China with technology transfer are going to have to navigate a minefield, with issues like dual use and things like that, because pretty much everything in our industry, no matter how commercial, is dual use in one way or another. So this is going to get really complicated for everybody in the aerospace industry. This week was a heck of an acceleration of all of those trends.
Although it does sound like even if a Biden administration is elected, that they're going to take, I think, a tougher line than we expected from the Obama administration. If you listen to Biden officials, they will say that, look, I mean, there needs to be reciprocity. We do need to be tough, but we need to be thoughtful about the relationship going forward. And I think that there is an extraordinary bipartisan consensus in Washington regarding the threat and the challenges that are being posed by. What is your guys' anticipation of what trade looks like? Right? Is this sort of principles-based trade with some technology transfer limits? Is this a hard shutdown? I mean, virtually every country is coming to the conclusion that by doing trade with China, what you're doing is empowering the country that will replace you on world markets, whether it's Germany and machine tools, whether it's America and aerospace products, whether it's Britain and finance and banking, although I think UK still has a little bit of an edge there, but obviously with the special status from Hong Kong, the US rescinding that, it puts British banks in a very, very tough spot. We saw Boris Johnson followed the United States, but Sash, as you've explained, right, it's not like the Johnson administration had a choice. The United States had effectively was going to stop anybody from using American chips in any network that has Huawei equipment in it. So how do you guys think, what does this trade look like going forward? Both good case and bad case.
Well, hey, let me just maybe frame it quickly. You know, it could go full decoupling of a universe that's the U.S. and allies, or kind of an allied group, including Europe and other countries. You could imagine a chunk of countries in Asia-Pac also signing up for that. So you sort of have China plus maybe its Belt and Road countries, and then, you know, the rest, and a complete decoupling, although that seems unlikely. What I've heard, you know, out of the folks I talk to anyway, is that you'll at least have a partial decoupling, and particularly on the areas that quote unquote matter. And that's a whole other discussion, and a lot of work can be done on that. But if you think about just the most recent experience with the pandemic and N95 masks, should, you know, the U.S. or Europe or whoever be self-sufficient in certain areas? Maybe they should. Does that have to be done, you know, in the U.S. or in Europe proper, or could it be done in a low-cost economy that maybe has a more friendly view towards the alliance, if you will, that doesn't include China? Maybe. So it seems to me that you'll end up probably somewhere that's some sort of hybrid, where it's partially decoupling in areas where it really matters, really hard decoupling in places, particularly where there's a threat with technology. I mean, there's been, you know, so much focus on 5G and microprocessors and so on and so forth. And then there's probably other areas where it just won't matter, right? So it I would imagine that's the end state. You know, how we get there is probably going to be, you know, I would imagine, pretty volatile on the way, and you're kind of a lot of back and forth. But I mean, that's how I think about it anyway.
You know, it's funny, where some leading strategists will say, you know, we don't really care where our chairs are made or tables or any, you know, not particularly high-tech equipment, but, you know, we will have a problem going forward on anything that involves technology, which is really where the value add in all of this is, right? I mean, it's not like I can get cheaper lawn furniture is where China is really important, because in that case, I can go to Malaysia, I can have it produced in Nigeria or any one of a number of other low-cost labor places around the world, right, at the end of the day.
But I think an important point to make, right, and this is a point I left out, is it's about leveling the playing field. I think the folks that tend to think very hard about the dynamic with China or any other country, is it a fair playing field where you have sometimes, you know, technology transferred that wasn't done willingly, right? I mean, you know, sometimes technology's taken. You have products that are thrown on markets at low prices that distort markets. You have a government supporting that. So in the end, it's really about a level playing field, I think, right? And the distortions right. That having this big player has caused.
Exactly. Sash, and then Richard?
Yeah, I mean, I'd focus on very little about to what Ron said there, but I think there's a couple of issues. I mean, number one, I just don't think technology transfer is ever fair. Technology transfer is a form of extortion. It's, you know, those are terms that are laid out to, you know, so that the country involved can try over time to not to have to buy from you again by acquiring your technology quicker, cheaper, more effectively than they would do if they all just sat in labs around all day and tried to invent it from scratch. But I think that the degree to which some Western firms have transferred astonishing amounts of technology to China for the C919 program, I think is to our shame, personally. I've been astonished by the degree to which some firms have been prepared to transfer systems integration skills that have a direct straight to the C919. And we shouldn't be surprised when, you know, let's say, as an example, Common Core computers then appear on J20, J30 aircraft. They said Bell 31 aircraft because we gave it to them. We gave it to them freely. I think as far as what does this look like, the best case for civil aerospace, and that's really what we care about here, is that the it's not that we stopped selling, the West stopped selling the Chinese civil aircraft. I don't think we would ever do that. It's that they stopped buying them. And therefore, the question is when. And that's effectively taking a punt on when the C919 will be ready for high volume production and Chinese airlines will then start buying it. My guess would be that is at or beyond mid-decade. But I think that anybody who is forecasting that China will continue to be 25-30% of the market, the whole civil aerospace market, for Boeing and Airbus in the second half of the decade is being woefully deluded.
I mean, Richard, I want to go to you. You know, in answer to the, in just a moment, but in answer to the fairness question, right, companies consciously made the decision to give up their technology to an authoritarian nation in exchange for access, market access, right?
Yeah,
that was the condition.
Yeah.
They didn't have to do that. Airbus did not have to start a helicopter factory. It chose to do so because it thought it could profit through that market access and bet that it could keep developing technology faster than this copier could do it, right? I mean, it's the classic mistake everybody made, right? The Japanese don't innovate really. You know, the Taiwanese don't really innovate. You know, we're just being nice and sort of giving them this technology and look at us, we're getting the benefit, not recognizing that, okay, there you're doing it with two democracies. In China's case, you've been doing it, right? So, I mean, the fairness thing has always rung a little hollow. It's what they've demanded. Had everybody just told them to go hike, they couldn't have made that demand, right? And it's just that everybody sort of appeased them because they thought that they could make money. Now they're surprised that they're out their technology and they'll get kicked out or be displaced from the markets in which they were leaders. So it's sort of like, okay, if you do three stupid things and you end up getting hurt, okay, right? So that's not really China's fault. Richard?
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to disagree, I think, with the thesis here. I think the Western companies involved have done a pretty good job here because, you know, there's two ways to develop an aerospace industry. One is a culture of innovation, and the other is a culture of copying. And they went down the latter path. I couldn't be happier. I am a little concerned about the Common Core computer. I'll refer to it as the Smiths Common Core computer because, of course, that'll make Sash happy, Smiths. Everybody else seems to have done, or a lot of others have done, a really good job saying, okay, well, you want technology transfer. Oh, and there's a factory across the road owned by AVIC that is obviously designed to rip off what we've got and replicate it. And the people in charge of certification are also the people in charge of everything. So therefore, here's our latest and best from 1987. And the result, of course, was the ARJ-21, the worst aircraft ever designed. Will the 919 be better? Yeah, probably kind of marginally. I mean, the best case scenario is 320 Neo 10 years later and without the product support infrastructure. So I'm not really quaking in my boots here. However, it is going to be a minefield to navigate from the standpoint of dual use. And the only choice, ironically, that the Trump administration and any successor administration is going to have is to massively step up the bureaucracy needed for trade with China. And then another thing to think about, you know, I think every Western company has been rather complacent with just-in-time from China, as referenced by the mask issue, the N95 mask issue. We're moving towards a just-in-case supply chain issue. In other words, either have a second production line over here or just a massive inventory of stuff that's built in China. And that, of course, is going to seriously erode the cost advantage of Chinese production, which indeed might be the point of the whole exercise from the standpoint of the anti-China trade crowd.
But my pushback on that is that, the you know, Richard, it's not about these two airplanes, right? Sasha's colleague, Nick Cunningham, you know, has done a little bit of a market-by-market analysis. And, you know, it buys the first three things. It co-develops the next three power plants or whatever it is. By the next three, it's on the competitive market. And by the last three, it's already displaced the heritage player, right? The trouble is the Chinese students, the best and the brightest of the country, have been studying at Cambridge and MIT. These aren't just copying guys. These are guys now who are actually generating patents in their own right, achieving a degree of success in the United States or in Europe and elsewhere, going and running factories, cutting edge factories in China, and then moving to some of these either state-owned concerns or private concerns in China, and benefiting from the education, the technological access, and massive amounts of capital that exist in the Chinese system to become globally competitive in their own right, right? So, you know, with all due respect, I understand that on this airplane, but I think if you look at the long-term trend, the worrying part of it is in every market China has set its mind to it, it has actually displaced heritage players that were leaders in that field ultimately, right? Ron, you had... Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, so look,
Wait a minute. Let Richard respond to that, and then we can...
Yeah, I'm not so sure the myth of Chinese invincibility is quite there, and it's starting to show up in their economic growth numbers. They're pummeling a lot of cash into state-owned enterprises, which can do great things from a market share standpoint and ultimately, you know, fritter away a country's wealth. And that's what's going on. They're losing the race to get rich before they get old. It's not going well. Now, in terms of aviation, it's been 50 years of this nonsense, and they've built a handful of aircraft. Am I quaking in my boots yet? No, not so much. And also, I think that the path they're going down is not towards displacing incumbents. It's towards replicating Ilyushin or Tupolev and coming up with import substitution products for a market that's closed. And as for these Chinese engineers that are being trained, remember, they would apply for patents, but can they Google these patents? Can they use any part of the Western information economy to do what they're doing? No, it's a closed society that really more and more resembles the old Soviet Union.
Yeah, but the difference, Richard, is that the old Soviet Union was actually economically very small, and it, you know, relatively, it's even smaller now. So Tupolev and Ilyushin, and I think that's quite a nice analogy. They could, you know, it was an issue of being the, you know, the tallest midget in the room for them. It was still actually a very small room, and they were not very impressive companies or products. China is different because it is so enormous. It is the largest single civil aerospace market. So if that becomes a closed market and COMAC dominates it, then Boeing and Airbus should be quaking in their boots because they've just lost a third of their whole production volumes. That really worries me. You know, and all it has to be is import substitution. Doesn't have to be any better than that. Import substitution for a market that is, you know, near a third of the world, that's enough to really damage the two incumbents.
Ron, you had a point you wanted to make. And then, unfortunately, we're going to have to move on as we have so much more ground to cover, although I would love to be able to devote a program to discuss this very issue. Go on, Ron.
So, yeah, a couple points I would add. Maybe bridging Vago and Richard. U.S. industry and the non-Chinese aerospace industry has been quite good at actually not manufacturing in China. So, you know, just from my own experience in the field, when you're the aerospace guy on an industrial field trip to China, there's not a lot to see. There really isn't. Most of the subsystems, everything that they tend to use is on the 919 is, like Richard pointed out, older technology or imported technology, right? And that's not to say that China can't figure it out one day. Most certainly they can, as Vago's pointed out, they have some bright students and so on and so forth, and a wealth of people and just wealth. So can they figure that out? Of course they can. But I would say a stark difference, at least from my vantage point, covering companies that have done both things. If you look at the passenger rail train business, European and North American companies built trains in Europe under JVs with Chinese companies, and then were surprised when the Chinese companies on their own were building high-speed trains that were competing with the products that were originally sent there. That's not what's happening in aerospace, right? The closest you have to it is a FAL for Airbus and a place where Boeing paints 737s. So far the industrial process between what's gone on in aerospace and what's gone on in other industries has been quite different. And I would say maybe with luck, some of it has to do with ITAR, maybe. But the industry, the commercial aerospace industry, so far really hasn't taught the Chinese how to do it. And that's not to say that they won't. But so far that, you know, hasn't happened, where in other industries it clearly has.
And I think that that's the abiding concern, is it's only a matter of time before they figure it out, right? And that's where it becomes challenging, and that's where it also becomes Interesting. An issue which we are not going to be resolving today. Did you have something you wanted to say, Richard? I thought, or it was Sash. Which one?
Yeah, I do. I just wish to break in here and now because somebody used the word heritage and legacy or both. But just to say that the
might have been me.
Just to say that the Battle of Britain Memorial flight has just flown over my house, a Lancaster, and at least two Spitfires, and it was a fabulous sound and sight. Just thought everybody should know that. And looking at it on Flight Radar 24, they were at 1,300 feet. Doesn't get much better than that.
Excellent. Yeah, sorry. That's the sound of six Merlins together is something that is just really terrific. Anyway, let's quickly move on. Stimulus packages. Anybody have anything to add, whether on this side of the Atlantic or in Europe? EU obviously has struck an $800 billion deal. United States looks like it's a couple of weeks away from striking it. Are these any needle movers and anything new that we need to say about this at all?
Well, I point out go ahead.
All I would say is the market, given what's going on in the market, is pricing in that the stimulus package will happen, right? So if, at least in the U.S., right? So if it doesn't happen, that would, you know, suggest there'll be some volatility ahead. So that's what I would say, that the market's already kind of thinking, yeah, this is going to happen.
Sash, anything you want to add to that from a European perspective that you didn't say last week?
No, listen, I agree with, you know, the market was expecting it. The EU always ultimately, you know, does a deal, comes to a deal. And you know, it's essential. It's absolutely essential. Actually, the news flow this week is going to be about the coronavirus spikes, you know, initially in Spain and where next, because if those spikes continue to increase, then that money and more is going to be needed.
Sash, put two British-related questions together for you to just sort of tick them off. There is this sense that the UK is going to be in a very, very bad way. Obviously, trade tensions with China are increasing. That was whether or not a golden market or at least a market. I mean, I remember it, you know, being over in the UK at DSEI, and there were folks who were still talking about China as being, members of parliament were telling me that it's like, well, you know, it's still possible to sort of work this out. We've got Brexit, which doesn't look like it's progressing. Warnings from German industry that a hard Brexit is likely. And on top of that, the trade deal that was supposed to have materialized doesn't look like it's going to be materializing, certainly in the last couple of months of an administration. And on top of that, we've got the national report on Russian interference in British politics. And the conclusion was that Russians have been involved. Russians have been involved even in, you know, people close to Putin giving money to Boris Johnson and his party. And yet nothing happened. And that it may have had an impact on the political dynamic from a cyber and other perspective. How is all of this massive news impacting British defense and aerospace ultimately? Or not?
It's not very much, particularly, you know, the defense and aerospace aspects, because it's just nowhere near as important in real money as the impact, potential impact of the coronavirus pandemic. You know, that is the existential threat, particularly to civil aerospace at the moment. By contrast, I mean, Brexit is clearly very, very significant. I actually think the progress on the Brexit talks depends on what journal you read and who they're quoting and what axe they are grinding. There were journals this week that were reporting there's actually been some progress, there's been some movement. I think it will go right up to the wire. Everybody will come away feeling pretty unhappy about some aspects of it. But, you know, you can't negotiate unless you're prepared to walk away, because otherwise you're just seen as being very, very weak indeed. I think in general, the negotiations by the British side have been done significantly better recently than they were under Theresa May, but you know it's going to be very tight. Actually, from the point of view of defence and aerospace, I think there is already a very clear understanding that in matters military, Brexit cannot be allowed to get in the way of the absolutely free, unfettered transfer of, in the first instance, missiles, and in the second instance, parts for space systems, and very, very soon, I suspect, parts of civil aerospace, and that you know, there will be, come what may, carve outs for the defense and aerospace industry, because it cannot be allowed to be affected by tariffs and just the general embuggerance of cross-border controls that will almost certainly crop up in some form. The Russian report was pretty depressing reading. It wasn't a huge surprise, frankly. It's been talked about in various forms for several years, and it's very apparent that the Russians have been, doing very successfully the sort of influence operations that we've always worried about. And regrettably, they've also been killing people on British soil, which is disgusting. This is not going to change UK-Russian relations anytime soon.
Because they're not particularly good. So it's not like it's going to make it that much worse. Although I think people better defending themselves against this sort of thing is very, very important. I'm not sure we're doing a good enough job here.
And there's two different issues, isn't there? I mean, there's cyber, and cyber, paradoxically, is defendable against if you have the will and the will and the skills. And there's influence operations, which is very, very hard to defend yourself against, because it is so damn insidious. And because it tends to be done indirectly through social media rather than directly through an advanced persistent threat.
We have a limited amount of time. Let's talk about A350-8, 737X delay, and even a 737 MAX delay in getting the airplane back into service. Ron, do you want to start that off? And then Richard, and then Sash, get your thoughts on it.
Yeah, press reports this week that 777X could be delayed up to a year or so, and not related to the previous delays that had to do with the engine. I guess ultimately that's not all that surprising. When we think about our financial modeling, we were assuming that anyway. But it just sort of pushes out that whole thing and makes it a little more expensive, honestly, right? Ultimately, if you have a delay in your big wide body program right now, nobody really wants those planes. So it's from a penalties point of view, it's if you're going to have a delay, it's probably a good time to have it. And then on 7-3, there was also discussion this week on some comments from the FAA saying basically on some level they want an international consensus about the operation of the 737 MAX and some of the technology changes on the aircraft, and that it looks like the earliest that the airplane could actually get back into service is probably sometime in October, which would imply scheduled service per airlines like Southwest and United and American have said it could take another 2 to 3 months to get the airplane back into scheduled service after that. So it doesn't look like you'll see 737 MAXs in scheduled service in the U.S. until very late in the year.
Richard, your take on what on this sort of slab of news means, aside from the fact that it's probably better it's happening now than it would have been happening at a time when the pandemic hadn't happened.
Yeah, I'm not so sure it would be happening now if it weren't for the market conditions, which are, of course, as Ron says, execrable. I'm hard-pressed to think of a compelling technical reason for it to be delayed for a year or even, frankly, months. This appears to be a story where there's, four or five customers that matter, and none really want a plane in this class right now, and indeed are retiring some of the planes they have in this class. So an impossibly bad time for this, especially since, the legacy 777-300ER and 200F models are getting pretty thin. So you could see down to one a month on the 777 line before the 8-9 come online, if indeed the 8 survives, probably will for one day being a freighter version or something. So this is just not a good time. And of course, on top of that, you had Dave Calhoun announcing a 25% cut in R&D. This is one way to cut R&D, just to space out the time needed to develop this. So I think it's less about a technical problem and more about a market problem and, of course, a company funds problem. None of that is welcome news.
But the welcome news is that they did sell some 767 freighters, which were obviously very, very big needle movers. Sash, give us your take, particularly on the 350 aid as well, and how that relates to the entire WTO suit that is not over and continues to play out in the background of this.
Yeah, I thought this was really interesting. Yeah, I mean, Airbus basically announced this week that it had done a deal, or it had accepted rewriting the terms of repayment of its launch aid, specifically France and Spain, interestingly, on the A350, to make the that portion of its launch aid, it says, wholly WTO consistent. And effectively, that means they would be repaying the launch aid at a much higher interest rate, and you know, reflecting the risks associated with the program. There's a lot of launch aid outstanding, 4.3 billion in total at the end of 2019, and we reckon 3/4 of that related to the A350, and a majority of that relates to France and Spain. So it's a billion eight plus of launch aid at much higher repayment terms. Let's say 2 million an aircraft, something like that, maybe even more. That is significant, given that the A350 has almost certainly gone back into loss again as the production rate has fallen. So why did Airbus do it at this stage? The statement doesn't read well. The statement, there's an element of to the US, take it or leave it, which I think never plays well in trade talks. It looks to me like blood and water. And it's basically trying to say, look, we're all in such a dreadful state. The industry is in such a dreadful state. Let's stop these negotiations now, or this battle now, because nobody's going to win. But actually, the US has just got quite a major concession here. So I was very, very surprised that Airbus should do it and do it this way this week. Pretty hard to see that being something accepted by this administration in its final months, because it doesn't seem to be you win many votes by that, whereas you would by continuing to push your advantage. But perhaps I'm just reading the administration wrong.
Ron and Richard, your take on the subsidies issue?
Well, if I may, from my standpoint, I thought it was welcome. Yeah, I agree completely with Sash that the likes of Peter Navarro or Robert Lighthizer are not about to say, oh, okay, yeah, we now love the Europeans and we're all happy. But on the other hand, I think everyone needs to start preparing the groundwork for unpleasantly higher levels of subsidization by the government of this industry. I don't think either side of the Atlantic quite understands what's happening next year, the year after, in terms of production rates. And frankly, there's going to need to be a higher level of government support, at which point the whole past issues of WTO, will be the proverbial handing out speed. It'll become the proverbial equivalent of handing out speeding tickets at the Indy 500. It's better to prepare the ground where both sides can enter negotiations for the future on a more or less same page basis. And that, I think, made it a useful proposal.
Ron?
Yeah, I don't have a heck of a lot to add to that. I agree with both Sasha and Richard.
Okay, lightning round now. So we go around the horn on earnings. Ron, start us off. Leading companies, Lockheed, Honeywell, others posted second quarter returns or first half returns. Sash, I want to get your take on Dassault and Thales as well. Ron, why don't you start it off on how these companies performed on U.S. markets and what they tell us for the future?
Yeah, just in a nutshell, Lockheed's quarter was a very strong quarter. Their backlog is the highest it's ever been. They generated strong cash flow in the quarter. Their underlying operating margins were quite good. They were a little more cautious in two of their segments in the second half of the year, largely around COVID-related delays, particularly in aeronautics. They had telegraphed that to the street before. I think, one of the more interesting reports is a company we don't follow at the moment that we have followed in the past, and we may follow again in the future, is Moog. They make precision actuation equipment, among other things. And their aftermarket business was down about 50%. Their OE commercial business was down 60%. But their commentary around, they thought this would be the low water mark because of COVID, that actually this might bleed into the second half of the year, and we might have several more quarters like this I think that was pretty insightful and kind of tells you how things are starting to slip. You know, that Nike swoosh is getting stretched out. And then finally, Honeywell, which I don't cover, one of my colleagues does, but their commercial aerospace results were similar to Moog's. I think their OE business was down somewhere in the mid-30s, and their aftermarket numbers were down higher than that. But it's in the coming, this upcoming week, we have a lot of companies reporting, and we're expecting to see kind of similar numbers, in some cases, maybe actually worse in terms of the aftermarket.
Sash, your take on where we are with both Dassault and with Thales, given they both have defense businesses, but they also have significant commercial operations as well.
I think the striking thing about Thales and Dassault is that actually, I mean, you're absolutely right. They are, you know, multi-industry businesses. But, you know, if you ask people to say, Dassault, what is it? I think, you know, most people say first and foremost, fighter jets. Thales is a defense electronics company, but boy, it was the civil businesses that bit both of them this week. And, you know, they reported Thursday night, Friday morning, shares were down 6% each on Friday, way below the market. These were ultimately disappointing numbers. Dassault has reduced its planned deliveries of Falcon business jets this year from 40 and originally 45 down to 30. So, you know, they're down a good third from where they thought they would be at the end of 2019. And actually, interestingly, within that, still some of those aircraft are unsold. So, you know, could it come in at 25? Yeah, absolutely it could. And what was also interesting is that they acknowledged that some of the potential Rafale export contracts, let's think, you know, Finland, Switzerland, follow-on order for India, possibly follow-on order for Egypt or Qatar, you know, somewhere like that. You know, the follow-on orders had slipped to the right because of coronavirus. Thales was slightly different. I mean, their civil aerospace business, the word they described for the civil aerospace business was that demand collapsed in the second quarter. That's really strong wording. You don't often hear people describing that. And their definition of collapse was worse than 50% OE aftermarket at the lot. But they are probably more optimistic about the full year and even, you know, recovery of margins through 2022-23. What the market is telling you and the share price, certainly at the end of last week, was that Thales's optimism about the recovery of margins. And margins topped out at 11% and were down at sort of 7-8%. But the market's telling you they just don't think that recovery is going to be as fast as Thales management thinks it is.
Richard, anything you want to add?
Well, I don't think it's terribly surprising to hear that the French are miles ahead of everyone else in terms of economic relief packages for aerospace. And of course, there's that report that came in the French Senate, I believe, where they were contemplating, on top of the $17 billion that has already been earmarked for various aerospace programs, another package that might even include another 20 Rafales. And since French Rafale procurement had basically fallen straight down while the company concentrated on exports and kept production at in the 2 per month or less range, there is the prospect of additional relief for French aerospace companies, which include the three bigs, being allocated in the French government in the coming months. And I expect that might even serve as a template for other governments that look to aerospace as a shovel-ready stimulus package.
Guys, thanks so very much for joining us. We really appreciate it. Always a pleasure having you on. Hope you all have a great week. Thank you.
Thanks, Vago. Great to be here.
Yeah, thank you, Vago.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.